The head of security called my house. He says, I thought you were coming into work today. I says, I'm here with my attorney. Would you like to talk to him? I handed the phone to Ron, and Ron took the phone and laid out to him some of the statutes of protecting whistleblowers that were in existence in those days.
Hello, I'm Jeb White. Welcome to Fraud in America. On this episode, we're going to travel up to Chicago and spend time with whistleblower Jim Holzrichter and his attorney, Michael Benn. Mr. Holzrichter's case, a whistleblower case filed under the False Claims Act, was filed in 1989. It was a case filed against Northrop Grumman, alleging that Northrop Grumman had fraudulently inflated costs and misrepresented the progress of a radar jamming device for the B-2 stealth bomber under an Air Force contract. Mr. Holzrichter was employed by the company. Before filing his case, he brought the alleged misconduct to the attention of the FBI and the Department of Defense. He was ultimately fired from the company. The case settled 17 years later for over $134 million. But today we're going to look beyond the numbers, look at the long, winding, challenging road that this case took, including a declination by the government. Mr. Holzrichter and his law firm had to move this case forward without the government for several years. Ultimately, the government decided to take a second look, re-intervene in the case, and the case ultimately settled. But that doesn't tell the full story. Today, we're going to do just that on this episode of Fraud in America.
Corporate fraud works best in the shadows, behind corporate walls. How does the government bring these wrongdoers to justice? Whistleblowers. These are the stories of those who risk their careers to shine a light on allegations of fraud. Today on Fraud in America.
Thank you so much to Mike Benn and Jim Holzrichter for joining us today on our third episode of Fraud in America. Definitely two of my favorite people in our world. And I want to start off by reading a review of Jim's book, A Just Cause, which is available on Amazon.com. I keep it on my back shelf here as a reminder about why I do what I do, which is all about making sure that whistleblowers get a voice in moving these cases forward. So the review, and I'll read it to you so you have an understanding of Jim's story broadly. When a seemingly ordinary and seriously underestimated family man discovers evidence of potentially massive mismanagement and fraud on the part of the U.S. defense contractor he works for, he desires to help the company itself, and his need to protect his newly healing family and newfound sobriety crash headlong into a 17, yes, not a typo, 17-year-long corporate assault on everything he holds dear, or knowing too much and refusing to ignore or help bury the cause. A Just Cause is a suspenseful yet inspirational real-life story of the power of the citizen, the potential for effective action in government, and the importance of family in trying times. It is a living testament to the enduring best of the human spirit and the fragility of democracy. It is, above all else, a celebration of heroes. Jim, at some point in your career, you made the decision to step forward as a whistleblower, first to report it to your management, but this decision to do something, when you see something, say something, a lot of people do nothing, but you made the decision to do something. Can you talk to us about that decision to actually do something?
It starts from my early youth. When I was younger, I just remember being around my father, and he would always tell me that when you grow up, you need to do the right thing. And he said something to me that always sounded in my head. And when is it, Jimmy, when is it ever wrong to do the right thing? So when you come up against something difficult, it's just something that I was at the center. If you tell the truth, you have one story to remember, just one.
Right.
And that really helped me get through so much. Because you don't have to worry about, well, what did I tell this person? What did I say there? How does this fit in? Because now I said this to this person. And after 8.5 days of a deposition of where you're constantly being asked a similar question from all different sides to try to see if you're going to change it up, You don't have to. It's the truth is the truth. And no matter how you paint it, it's just what it is. And so that's what helped me to realize that I needed to do something. I tried to bring it internally. There was so much going on at the time, too, that in the news and movies that were coming out of persons of integrity, as I call them, that were being minimized and marginalized and even injured or damaged. And so it was fearful. And who do you trust, both inside or outside of the government, inside or outside of the company? Where do you go to take this? I had no idea. No idea. It was so isolating.
Jim raises a good point that is true of many successful whistleblowers. And Jim, he wasn't looking to go to the government. He wasn't looking to go to the media. He was just looking for Northrop to do the right thing. So what do you do in that situation if you're a whistleblower? Jim went to his boss. And what's his boss say? Well, let sleeping dogs lie. So, you know, what do you do when your boss isn't doing anything? You go to your boss's boss. That's what Northrop told him to do. So he goes to his boss's boss. What'd she say? What the government doesn't know won't hurt him. So Jim tried to report this internally. He tried to do what the company said he should do. So before he went and took the steps he did, he tried to do what a good corporate employee should do.
It's such a common story that we're hearing from every single person that comes on this show, right? This recognition that, well, you know, maybe they just don't know, or maybe if they just knew, they would change their ways. And oftentimes the people that step forward are the ones who are alienated, isolated, and then terminated. So the story that seems to happen time and time again. Before we get into allegations, take us back prior to all this. At some point you decided to accept a job at Northrop Grumman. What were you working on there? Why did you take this job? What was interesting about it?
Well, I had been in the Coast Guard during the Vietnam era. I'm a Vietnam era veteran. And I had studied electronics when I was in the Coast Guard. It's what I was trained to do, was to be a radioman and navigator and electronic technician on Coast Guard aviation. It's something I've always wanted to do. I remember walking in the streets of Chicago and my friend Wood was on the way to school. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I says, I want to be an electronic technician. And that's what I became. And I just loved it. But when I got out of the military, there was a freeze on hiring at that time, and it was difficult to find a job to support my family, so I got into construction, just something to put food on the table. But my love was still with electronics. And eventually, when the opportunity to become employed by Northrop arose, I applied, and I received the offer for the job to be an electronic technician building electronic testing equipment for different aircraft that are housed within the government that Northrop was working on, the B-1 bomber, the F-15 and 16 fighters, and the avionics that was on board. I would instruct, the engineers would design test equipment, and then they'd give us the schematics, and we would gather all the parts and build them from the schematics, and that's what I was doing.
This was the era of Reagan's evil empire speech. Mm-hmm. So yeah. This was really at a very hot point in the Cold War, and the Northrop's facility out in Rolling Meadows made the best radar jammers in the world. I mean, people would come here from Israel, from Saudi Arabia, from France to buy their radar jammers. And it was at this defense buildup in the Reagan-Bush era that Jim walked into.
So this is top technology. Stealth technology. This is not an area where you're looking for contractors to cut corners, if ever anywhere, right? So you're involved in this, and at some point you're pass crossed with Rex Robinson. Am I getting the timeline right here? Did you know Rex prior to all these allegations coming forward?
No, I did not know Rex. Mm-hmm. Who I knew was another engineer at Northrop, was Jim Fredericks. And I used to ride to work with him, and him and Rex worked together. And when I started to find out things that were starting to bother me because they just didn't add up and the numbers were extremely large, that I would express my concern, but not what it involved. I would just say, I'm worried. Well, they worked in another part of the company in the black programs, as they were called. They were so secret. So this, you got to remember, this is at the time that the stealth bomber wasn't even acknowledged of being in existence. Congress denied it.
Right.
But they were working on, that's what they were working in those programs that involved the stealth bomber. And they called those SP programs, special projects. And theirs was SP3. My task at the time was to track inventory as it came in and out of the company and how it operated on the floor and things like that. And so I saw a much, much bigger picture because they were just focused because of compartmentalization, as it was called. Only several people saw the entire program, whereas I got to see all the stuff coming in. I didn't see the actual stuff, but I saw the parts coming through to supply all the different builds going on. It gave me a unique perspective because what was happening is this, things were being bought for this particular part of a program and being shifted and moved around and used on other parts of the program that they weren't supposed to be, or even entirely different programs altogether, as they were shifting and moving parts about to the advantage of wherever they can obtain the most profit. And parts that were failing at an upper level, and then they were going down and they were taking parts out and reusing them, and they were coming up being charged again for the same part as if it was a new part entering inventory. So all of this, I'm seeing all of this, and then I was tasked to track down to see what was going on and report to upper level management, the vice presidents of the corporation, and even to the there at Northrop Grumman in Rolling Meadows, to the CEO there, was receiving these reports on a weekly basis.
So Mike talked about what you did and how they told you to stop looking and stop working so hard, right? So you decided at some point that you weren't getting any traction within the company, is that right? And then decided you need to look elsewhere for help. How'd that play out?
What happened is that at one point I was yanked into Northrop Security because of my concerns that I was voicing to my supervisor and then his supervisor and kicking it up the food chain, so to say. I'm brought into Northrop Security and accused. They said that they saw me pull into a gas station, open up my trunk and take out a box of what looked like documents and give them to some guy who was waiting there for me. I went by an employee and I says, who told you this? Who made this allegation? I says, that never happened. It never happened. This was before any of my involvement with the federal government and the investigation.
Wow.
It was something I had never even crossed my mind. But it put me on notice that I needed to protect myself, really protect myself. And it was at that point that I started making copies of everything for myself, not just the stuff that I was having, and putting them somewhere else than around where my desk was, because I didn't want to become the scapegoat. Well, here's the person who's doing all of this. And then there was an incident of where there was an employee who had just, federal agents came in and took him out of the building. They arrested him. He was a purchasing agent who was basically telling his vendors that he would give them the contract or buy things from them if they gave him some kickbacks. So that had taken place at that time. So all this is going on and it's creating this level of fear. And you see all of these cameras everywhere. And so you have to be so careful. And I just started from, they had, you couldn't go somewhere and make copies of anything for yourself. There was no copy machines available for the employees to copy stuff.
Yeah.
So you'd go to the copy center and you'd write out your request to have copies made. And I started getting an extra copy, just one extra copy, because I was making multiple copies anyway to distribute to the different managers and vice presidents. I just added one more for myself. And those are the ones I started to put somewhere so that I would have them available if I were ever accused of being involved in this.
I want to remind people the dates on this. So this is pre-Enron, pre-WorldCom, pre-really False Claims Act. And the False Claims Act had been amended just a couple of years prior to this time period. Wasn't really something a lot of people knew about. Certainly wasn't the behemoth that we know now. You know, Mike, this is such a common story, right? The should have been employee of the month ends up becoming a whistleblower because the company really handles it so poorly.
Absolutely. My best clients and the most successful whistleblowers are just honest people who find themselves in an impossible situation where the company is asking them to do something that violates the company's own code of ethics and the person's own code of ethics. So by the time someone comes into my door as a whistleblower, they're really the victim of a corporate crime. They don't want to become whistleblowers. They don't want to be in this situation. Yet, like in Jim's case, it turns their lives upside down.
So, Jim, you know, I always highlight your story because you experienced so many things that whistleblowers experience, but all wrapped up into one case. You experienced so much over the 17-year period. And still goes on, you know, some of the lessons that you're sharing. I call you the professor in-house. You're the professor Holtz Richter teaching people the lessons from your case. So in 1989, your case is filed as a False Claims Act QI-TAM action. We mentioned Rex earlier. How did this relationship go forward as far as you guys being co-relators, deciding to file a QI-TAM action and this False Claims Act that people are starting to dust off during this time?
Well, prior to that, in 1988, I was contacted by a federal agent at my home because he was working at Northrop on another case that was brought to his attention by Rex Robinson, who had gone previously to the FBI in time card fraud. His allegations were that they were putting people in rooms and charging to a program as they were supposedly waiting for security clearance that was given to them by the company and charging the government for that, but inappropriately. They weren't working on other things. They were reading newspapers. They were going out to lunch and doing everything, you know, as they were supposedly waiting. And this went on, dragged on for months as they waited for these clearances. But those were his allegations that I found out later that it came. Because he had gone to the FBI, there was a purge at Northrop at the time where they were downsizing, they were saying, and he became one of the people, and so did everyone who worked on that project. There were three of them who left the company, and they filed a age discrimination case against Northrop at that time. And they were making their allegations of fraud in some of the programs they were working on in the SB program. But the thing is that the program was still so super secret, the attorneys didn't have the proper clearances that they couldn't even discuss what they were doing with the attorneys without violating national security. So it made it difficult for the attorneys to go forward. In the interim, I had been working for about a year, year and a half with a federal agent, Richard Zott, who was leading up the program at the time, and his partner, Elizabeth Lischka, who later on became his wife. They contacted me at my home. I was scared to death. Oh, my goodness gracious. I got the call at night, and this was in January of 1988.
Were you married at this time? You're married to Mary.
I've been married since 1973.
Wow. So, yeah. And any children?
Five children and six grandchildren.
During this time, you also had children and a family and
Yes. Yes. And I was in recovery as well at that time. Yeah. And I worked with Northrop to help get their EAP program up and running, their employee assistance program. And I was their liaison for people who were experiencing recovery and coming back to work and letting them know that the company was there for them and all of that. I was a model employee.
Right.
And so I get home and the phone rings And I'm in the living room, and Mary answered the phone in the kitchen. And she goes, Jim, there's someone on the phone for you. So I go into what the little alcove where the other phone is. It's high technology with the 100-foot extension cord on it. I can walk around the house with my phone, and, you know, now we just use a cell phone, but back then you had to be plugged in. So he goes, hello, my name is Richard Zott, and I'm a federal agent with the Defense Criminal Investigative Service of the Attorney General's Office.
Right.
I couldn't breathe. I mean, I says, who are you? And he repeated it again, who his name was. I says, give me a second. And my daughter's room is there. So I go in there and I close the door and the cord's under the door. And I, you know, your knees feel weak. And I sit down on the edge of her bed and I says, how can I help? How can I help you?
Yeah.
And then he explains that he says he became aware that I might know of some improprieties going on at Northrop. And I'm going, well, who told him that? Unbeknownst to me, because of my concerns, I was telling the person I was writing with none of the things that were going on, but that there were things going on that really concerned me. And so he told Rex, because that was Jim Fredericks. They worked together. They were both all laid off at the same time.
Right.
And so Rex had told the FBI. The FBI told the DCIS, and Richard contacted me.
Wow.
So he starts explaining that, and I'm just running through my head, how can I get out of this? I mean, I had just been interrogated by Northrop Security not even a week or so before that and accused of this very thing. Is this Northrop on the phone trying to see, well, we'll see if Jim's a good company guy. Let's see, what is Jim going to do?
Right.
So I'm thinking, well, I'm being set up by Northrop. That's what's running through my head. So I says, well, you know, he goes, he wanted to talk to me. And I says, well, I says, there's no way I can verify your credentials. I don't have the resources to see if you really are a federal agent. You could be a foreign agent for all I know. I says, I tell you what, I'll go into Northrop tomorrow morning and tell them that you contacted me. And they will verify your credentials, and then we'll set up a meeting that I can get together and talk and see, you know.
Right.
And this is what I'm thinking about, because I'm thinking about the procedures that you're supposed to do if you're contacted by anyone who alleges to be a federal agent and stuff like that. And I go, well, that'll put me on the square with this, if this is Northrop. And he goes, well, Jim, let me tell you the reality of what's going to happen. He says, you're going to go into Northrop tomorrow morning, and I guarantee you that within 5 minutes, they will have you in front of their corporate lawyer, and he's going to scare the hell out of you. And you're not going to talk to me. And then I'm going to come see you with handcuffs, and put you in prison.
Wow.
And I says, what time can you be here tomorrow? So, and that was really interesting, because the next day you see this nondescript car pull up. It doesn't have government plates on it that say, you know, like the G that's on it for a government car.
Right.
And I see these two people get out of the car. Richard and Elizabeth. I see him put his gun on and put his jacket on over it. And they come up the stairs up to the house and they knock on the door. And I open the door and he shows me his badge and his car and all that, and who they are. They already knew who I was, because immediately he didn't say, are you Mr. Holzrichter? Or are you? He knew. But they already knew. But it gave me a sense of relief, because I figured now there's somebody who can do something about
right. The
things that I have been seeing, because they weren't being taken care of at the company. And I was just relieved. The cavalry is here, so to say.
You were relieved. Wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I spent the next 3 hours with a whiteboard.
Yeah.
Laying out everything that I had found. And I even remember asking him, do you want me to give you some documents that I've got at my desk? And he goes, no. No, he says, I can't ask you to do that. So, but the thing is if I did that of my own free will, without his instigation, I later found out, it couldn't then be construed that I was setting the company up, because it was a voluntary on my part. He didn't ask at all for that. And so later on, when I was bringing documents to him, it was under that, rather than him saying, well, I want you to go in and do this, I do that. You know, that wasn't that at all.
Beautifully told, Jim. This story of, you know, that feeling of what do I do now is a feeling that so many people have, right? Whenever they feel like they're doing the right thing and the company's saying, turn a blind eye or pack your bags. And here comes the cavalry. The word you used was you were relieved. That's interesting and very telling about where your mind was at this point. Can you talk about, so at some point you did file a QTAM case though. So can you talk about, you know, why you decided to take that action and what happened after that?
Well, what had happened is that in late May, early June of 1989, I was brought into Northrop Security and sequestered in this little room, one door, a desk with a chair, and the head of security there. And he's standing between me and the door as I'm sitting there. They told me that they had found my security badge. It's the thing, magnetic thing that lets you open doors and things like that. Because a few weeks before, supposedly I had lost it. I had to get a new one. And they says, hey, we found it. Come and get it. And he said, and he's standing, he goes, oh, Jim, by the way, before you go, there's a few things I just want to ask you. And he goes, have you heard of any federal investigations going on here at Northrop? Now, remember, I had already been working with the federal agent for over a year, taping documents to my body, bringing them out past security. Being asked to wear wires in meetings and for over a year. And I'm terrified because now he's between me and the door. Silkwood had just aired recently. I had just watched that movie. So of course I'm going, oh my goodness, I'm going to wind up in somebody's trunk. These are all feelings that I'm really scared and feeling. And I just quickly am thinking, and he goes, I don't want to be dishonest and outright lie to him.
Wow.
But he asked me, do you know of any? And in my mind, I'm going, well, I don't know of any. I know of one.
Depends on your definition of is, right? Okay, yep.
Right. And so, yeah. And so I says, well, I don't know of any investigations going on at Northrop. He goes, well, oh, okay. He goes, because there's a... an investigation here going on, and there's a I'm trying to think if he used the term whistleblower or there's somebody cooperating with them. And I go, no, really? And he goes, yes. And he works for product assurance. He says, you're kidding me. He goes, no. And his name is Jim Holzrichter.
Wow.
I couldn't swallow. I couldn't. And I'm going, well, what happens next? I asked, What I says, I can't be here. I can't. And he starts to, he goes, well, what is this about? And I says, everything I already told you about. Because wow. He was the head of security that I told about
yeah.
a lot of the things that I had brought to the attention of the government when they had contacted me.
Right.
And in his investigation, he explained to me that, well, it was only the one particular part was $500,000, and that's nothing to the amount of work we do here. And so I was told not to even report it. What he told me is this culmination of the one part of the investigation. But when you take $500,000 and you add that up several hundred times, that's not something small.
Yep.
And that's what these problems were amounting to. Hundreds of millions of dollars. So he says, well, what are you going to do? I says, I need to find legal. I said, and but in the interim, those three guys who had been laid off already had given me the phone number of an attorney who was representing them in their false discharge, and they were claiming age discrimination was why they were being laid off to get yep. something back from the company. They knew why they were, because they were bringing allegations. Well, one of them was himself. The other two came, we kind of found out, were just parroting what the one person said. They were parasitic. But that was the number of Ron Futterman. So as soon as I left the company,
Chicago attorney,
he was an attorney.
Yep.
I called him. In those days, they used to have those things that were known as payphones. So I pulled at a gas station.
I've heard of these things. Yes.
Yeah. And I called Ron. And he says, well, I'll be at your house tomorrow morning. Don't go into work tomorrow until I talk to you.
Yeah.
And I'll be at your house in the morning. And he was. He was at my house the next day at 9 in the morning. He showed up at my door. And that was the first time I met Ron. He really helped me a lot. He was there. And it was so funny because the head of security called my house. He says, I thought you were coming into work today. I says, I'm here with my attorney. Would you like to talk to him? I handed the phone to Ron, and Ron took the phone and laid out to him some of the statutes of protecting whistleblowers that were in existence in those days.
Yeah.
And then I was okay. So I had the rest of that day off, and I went to work the next day. But Ron really laid it on the line to him. But when I went to work the next day, everything at my desk was gone. Everything. There wasn't even a spent staple or a bent paperclip. Nothing was left. It was all gone. Personal items, all the work I had been doing there for the last 5 years, everything around my desk was gone. People avoided me. In one day, it only took a day. And they were so afraid to be associated with me, to be linked with somebody. They had no idea what was going on. They said all they knew is that a bunch of security people showed up on my desk and took everything.
Right.
I'm not there 10 minutes before I have the head corporate attorney there at my desk saying, the CEO wants to talk to you. Well, in all of the 5 years I'd been there at Northrop, I never spoke to Wally Solberg, not once.
Yeah.
So I called Ron. And Ron talks and says, have you ever met with this guy before? And I go, no. And he goes, that's not in the normal performance of your duties. So he says, no, you can't talk to him. So Ron talks to the corporate attorney, Eric Howell, and tells him that. So then next thing I know, I'm in the office with Murray Snow, who's the head of the vice president of product assurance. And he's white. His face is white. And I'm in there with him and the corporate attorney. And he says, well, you can understand why we can't retaliate or do something, you know, to restrict your normal job duties. But you can understand our concern. Because we don't want to let the wolf loose amongst the sheep.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, I'm the wolf? I'm not the wolf.
Yeah.
And so, and then they use a process of elimination to see some of the things that I might have told the federal agents and the government by asking me what I can continue to work at that won't expose the company to further possible damage from the allegations that will come. Every day for about 3 weeks, they show up at my desk, asking me questions. It was very stressful. Very, very stressful.
Are you doing work during this time? Are you actually doing work, or are you just
sitting? Yeah, I was at work.
Were you doing work, or are you just sitting at your desk?
Yes, I was. I was doing busy work. I was doing some work. They gave me back some clearance to the computers and things like that. What was funny is that in this box I had by my desk were some documents I hadn't gotten to Richard yet. And when I says, well, there were some drawings that I had done in there for designing the special projects lab where they were environmentally testing some of this equipment. Yeah. They gave me back the box, and in the bottom of the box were all these documents. And I says, are they trying to set me up? Are they trying to see now if I, are they going to take these documents here? I brought them over to the copy center, made copies of them. And I took, and I'm thinking, do they watch the same spy movies I do at this time? Because I had a thermos bottle that I would bring my soup or coffee in. And then take the top and take the liner out. And I'd wrap the documents around the internal liner and then put it all back together and screw it back together. And that's how I got those documents out and gave them to Richard. They weren't the originals. They were copies.
Copies, yeah.
And that's so important that you don't take originals out of the company. Or you have those in a place that later on in the event of a subpoena or a search warrant, they know where they're at within the company.
Yeah. And that's actually a nice point for me to interject here, Jim. You all, there's a lot of people, hopefully, listening to this who are thinking about becoming whistleblowers or identifying something wrong. And instead of going along with the sheep, they're thinking about stepping forward. And all the actions that Jim was talking about, you know, we encourage people to reach out to legal counsel before doing any of these things. But this is Jim's story. So Jim, you're at work, kind of working. You have corporate documents coming out in your thermos. Did you continue working there all the way up until you filed your key TAM action, or did at some point you leave?
No, I left. I wound up in the hospital. I had chest pains that were mimicking a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you at this point? How old were you in 80?
1989.
Yeah.
I was born in 54.
So wow. Way too young to be having chest pains.
Yeah. So that made me in my early 30s. About
wow.
All this is going on. And the doctor says, this is situational anxiety. If you keep it up, you will have a heart attack. You will. Because you're in constant state of panic, constant state of fear. Is somebody following me? You know? It was very, very frightening. This is right at the time that we filed that. And then the federal investigation really ramped up after I was exposed. Oh my goodness, the grand jury was convened. There were hundreds of subpoenas to documents to Northrop that were going on at the time. I was asked to work with the FBI and the DCIS and the DCAA, all of these alphabet soup of, agencies to go through documents that were being provided for their grand jury. And help them to go through them and identify what they should be watching and looking for on the criminal side of the case. It created a lot of stress. And so the doctor says, you need to take a leave of absence for your health. And so I left in June after a meeting that was held at Ron Futterman's office between myself, the federal agencies, the federal agent, Northrop, and the head of Northrop Security were all there. And of course, their high-powered attorneys that they brought in. And we had that meeting, and I never went back. They had no problem with me taking a leave of absence that way, short-term leave of absence that turned into a constructive discharge.
Okay, yep, right.
And so... the case was, I worked with Ron and them to help get my allegations of the case. He said he figured that at that time they were saying whistleblowers were nothing but disgruntled employees filing these actions that just trying to get a settlement from the company to make some pocket change or money for themselves. And there was a little blurb that was in the paper of a disgruntled employee, meaning me. That came out in the Tribune at that time. And we constructed my part of the complaint. The other three gentlemen who were in the case, one of being Rex Robinson, were also working on their allegations. And the case was then filed under seal. And in August of 1989, the case filing was 89C-6111.
Wow.
Anyone who wants to look that up? It's a number that I don't think I'll ever forget.
We'll link to all the underlying documents. Not all of them, because they go on. If you look at the docket, if you have access to PACER, it's quite a number of documents filed over the
voluminous. Over 1,000 motions. Over 1,000 motions flying back over the years.
Had you heard of the False Claims Act prior to this period? Never.
Yeah. I had no idea that law existed. Not at all. You're talking in 19. I came to find out in 1986 it was given its teeth back, that it had been gutted during World War II.
Right.
And that's all I knew at the time after that. And Ron Futterman told me about it. So he said that it would be better if there was a cadre or more than just one whistleblower. So I had never met personally Rex until then.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never met one of the other whistleblowers, Lynn Osterheim, until then. Jim is the one I used to ride to work with, but he never told me what their concerns were. And they didn't at this time either. And so I go, okay, we'll have this multiple relator whistleblower complaint go in. And I'm just one of these four guys with my own discrete allegations coming into this case. And so he put us together. That was brought together.
Gotcha.
You know, we didn't come together and go to the attorney. I went to the attorney and he says, hey, I've got these three other guys. Let's put you all together.
Yes. Yeah. So this is 1989. The government, you know, we talked about in earlier episodes how the False Claims Act works, right? The government looks at the allegations raised in the complaint, looks at the disclosure memo that includes a lot of the evidence that Jim and his co-relators are bringing to the case. And then 1992, so 3 years later, the government declines the case, right? So whenever you found out that the government is declining the case, in other words, that they've looked at it and they've decided that they are not going to intervene in the case and take over primary responsibility of moving the case forward. Can you talk about that when you found out about the government's decision not to intervene at that time?
Well, I got a little inkling of that this might happen. The FBI would pick me up at the train station in Arlington Heights to bring me over to the FBI office in Arlington where they were having these documents. And the federal agent asked me, Jim, he says, what would you do if the government decided not to intervene? I says, oh, I would continue this and pursue it. And he goes, good, good. And it was soon after that that the decision was made not to intervene by the government. It was a rather strange reason why. They were saying that they considered the Air Force to be their client, and their client didn't want them to pursue this. So therefore, in the interest of following the recommendation by their client, they were declining to intervene criminally and civilly in the case.
Why do you think the Air Force would not be interested in them moving forward against the primary contractor that's building these airplanes for them?
It's because where else are they going to get their toys? They wanted that equipment. And also because of contacts. Who do you know? What power can you apply and favors you can call in? It was likened to the time by one particular person in authority. He said it was like saying that Northrop robbed the bank and the Air Force drove the getaway car. That was one of the comparisons that were given to us by one of the agents.
One of the big reasons, and I'm sure people can recognize why I wanted Jim and Mike to join me today, is I want people to understand that there are going to be times when the government, because of limited time, money, resources, or something else, simply cannot intervene in the case or make a decision that they cannot intervene in the case. And the beautiful thing about the False Claims Act is that in those instances where there's a meritorious case, the relator feels like they can move forward and their counsel can help them with that. The False Claims Act allows the relator to go forward with the case on behalf of the government to pursue those who are stealing from the government and jeopardizing government dollars and programs and patients' lives. And that is why the ability to go forward without the government is so important, because there's going to be times when the government simply cannot or will not intervene in the case. And this is a case study in why that is so important. Mike, I'd like to turn to you. I know you didn't get involved in this case for a couple more years. In 1994, I guess you left the U.S. Attorney's Office, left the government, joined the relator side, and you and Ron and that firm moved forward with this case. Why was the decision to go forward without the government? During this time, the False Claims Act was still kind of an unproven law, but you guys decided, let's go, right?
Well, I'll tell you, I had been with the government prosecuting fraud on Wall Street. I was with the Southern District of New York office as a federal prosecutor. And I specialized in fraud in the futures market. Well, I thought that was complicated till I saw defense contracting fraud. And defense contracting fraud is a whole other level. I mean, you add several zeros to any number you've ever seen just to start. The numbers are staggering. And then it's a whole Alice in Wonderland world. You have progress payments, supposedly, that have nothing to do with progress. You have so-called fixed price contracts that aren't actually fixed price. And you have the lawyers who represent Northrop who are fighting the government about defrauding the government. These lawyers are being paid for by the government. So it was just a very strange world that we came into. But Jim and his colleagues, Jim and Rex, just had such a compelling argument and were just such great people and had done such courageous acts that myself and my firm believed very much that the case should go forward and they deserved and the taxpayers deserved to get to the bottom of this. So we began what was a very, very long and drawn out battle, basically on ground zero, because all of the investigation that the government had done that Jim described, these hundreds of subpoenas and all these witnesses, that was all grand jury. So it was under the law, grand jury investigations are secret. So we didn't have any of the benefit of the government investigation. So in 1992, when it came out from under seal, we were starting over again. Not only that, we were in a bit of a hole because we were starting late. But we were committed to Jim and committed to Rex and committed to getting the truth out. And little did we know how much that would take.
Amazing. So there's some, by the way, we'll link to some of the court decisions. Some great court decisions came out. They fought back against motions to dismiss. One, therefore, they were allowed to go forward with discovery, which is where they can go to the defendant and start getting these documents together, the evidence, subpoenas, all these things happen on just like any other case. And it takes 8 years of battling Northrop, right, Mike, before the government takes a second look and decides, well, maybe we will intervene in this case.
It was extraordinarily difficult. Northrop fought us tooth and nail at every juncture. And we looked at over 3 million documents and over 8 million inventory records to get to the heart of things. Not only that, we had a very hostile judge on the case who was ruling on discovery motions. And he was just kind of odd. He wrote one of the only court decisions I'm aware of that uses the word menage a trois. What the judge did was see the relationship between the relator on one side of the bed, the defense contractor on the other, and the government in between as what he called, not me, in a court opinion, he called the government the tease of the three in a menage a trois. And the government and this judge was just so against us. In one hearing, he banged his gavel against us so hard he broke his gavel. So it was against that we were clawing through to get these documents, but it was through Jim's and Rex's and our own, frankly, studying of what was going on here to try and understand the facts of the case that enabled us to put together something short and to the point that would convince the jury that what Jim and Rex were seeing was, in fact, the truth.
So this motions practice that went on for several years, Jim and Rex, you guys are playing an active role too during this time. What are you guys doing to help move this case along?
Well, I was going down to Mike's office. I was going to the depositions. Every deposition that was held in Chicago, I went to. The court hearings, I went to, because as I said to Mike and the other attorneys, I'm going to put a human face on this. This isn't just lawyers going to court arguing over money back and forth against these mind-numbing numbers and facts. I want the judge to look me in my face as much as possible and realize that human lives are involved in this. And it was, I felt, very important to do that. Judge Guzman, a remarkable judge. He saw right through a lot of the subterfuge, and it's remarkable some of the decisions that he had made in the case. Being there, meeting the DOJ attorneys, the civil attorney, Linda Wazinski. I mean, oh my goodness gracious, talk about a wonderful litigant. It was very dedicated, very behind this case. She's been there for many other relators, whistleblowers through the years too. I mean, they really put it all on the line to see this case to fruition. So I really appreciated all of that. When we talk about, sometimes people say the government, we have to remember there are people who work there. There are policies, there are decisions that are made above their head, but these are people who are really dedicated and want to see these things come out properly. And I can't speak enough to these people as those both inside and outside of government who came forward to see this case to its conclusion after that 17 years. And then 6 years of follow-on litigation that I went through after the case ended as well. So this is so far involved, you know, almost 25 years of my life tied up in court in this case.
Not only were they so helpful in through discovering and helping us with discovery, but pretty early on in the case, in about 1995 or 1996, the judge sponsored some settlement negotiations. And Northrop offered Jim and Rex each $1 million each to drop the case. And their first question was, well, what does the government get? And it's, guys, well, the government offered you guys $1 million, but the government nothing. And they said, no deal. Both of these guys walked away early in the case from $1 million apiece because the taxpayers would not get their due.
Jim, if you're willing, and you share this in your book, and I think it's important for people to hear, can you talk about your personal situation during this time, the struggles that you're going through, and they're offering you $1 million and you say no?
Well, you have to understand that being a father, I have 5 children, my wife, seeing to their needs. I couldn't find a job to really support them. We wound up in a homeless shelter. Receiving public aid, food stamps, to be able to sweeping parking lots for $20 a week. To go from, at that time, making $35,000 a year to nothing. Everything you work for is gone. And also holding on by my fingernails to sobriety because of having gone through treatment on January 29th, 1985. And through all of this, I maintained at least my sobriety, maybe not my emotional issues. Some of the assaults that were put on me by Northrop and the allegations that were coming forward as they were going to try to destroy me emotionally in some medical documents that were released to them. They just subpoenaed the treatment center, the psychiatrist, counselors for their medical, and they just gave them all to them. Yeah. And, you know, you bare your soul as you're trying to put a lot of your past actions in perspective to move forward in your life. It was devastating to me. Absolutely. It was emotional rape. I remember going down to Ron's office when he told me that, these documents, these medical documents had come out. It was during the time of my deposition. And it was a legal maneuver on the part of them to crush me. And I get this packet, this thick packet of these, all these from my doctors and all of that. And I'm back on the train on the way home. And I wrote about it in my book. And I open it up. I go, I need to see this. I need to see what they're going to hit me with. And I start reading it. And the tears just start falling from my eyes. And wetting the pages, and I'm riding home on that train. And they go, oh my goodness, my family is going to find about things that, you know, I thought, things that I had experienced. They're going to try to wreck me and destroy me, saying, you know, and vilify me. So I had to get ahead of that. I sat down with my wife and I shared with her things that a man should never have to share with his wife. And then sit down and tell your children some of these things, because they were going to weaponize this. And I figured I'd rather be the one to tell them than them tell them. And so, and you sort of like, whether it's real or not, you know, your children look to you as their father, you know, in this figure. And you sort of see the light go out a little bit in their eyes as their image of you as their father changes, their perspective. That whether it's true or not, but you think you see that, what that does to your heart. And then I called Mike. He rescued me. Because he helped me put it in perspective. He said, Jim, he said, those things happened to you. You were a victim when those things happened to you.
Right.
That helped me to start healing more and really dig in. And yeah, I got more tenacious.
When people ask me, you know, what do I do for a living? I don't like to use the term attorney. I don't like the term lawyer. I like to say I'm a counselor. Right? We're counselors at law. And it seems like that in this area of the law, that title is earned, right? This seems to be a role we play quite often, right? Counseling our clients through some really difficult times like this.
Very, very much. Very much so, Jeff. As you've mentioned, these cases are filed under seal. So the relator, the truth teller, the whistleblower, who's going through some of the most difficult times of his life, having to come forward and deal with the legal system and deal with lawyers and deal with the employer and the loss or potential loss of the job, highly stressful, highly difficult life events, can't talk to anybody, really can't talk to anybody other than their lawyer. And that's why it's so important for us as QTAM lawyers to understand what folks like Jim go through. Yep. And to be a willing ear, to be available 24/7 when they want to talk. All my clients have my cell phone number, and I've talked to them very often around the clock because it's such a difficult situation to be in. And frankly, I learn as much from them, especially Jim has been a great teacher to me in terms of how to best help my clients, whistleblowers like Jim, go through the process. And I'm very grateful to Jim and to my other clients, not only for their courage and for their inspiring conduct, but for helping me help others in similar situations.
So in 2001, after all of this, you find out that the government is going to re-intervene in your decline case. What went through your head at that time, Jim?
Oh, my goodness. It was a happy dance. I thought this is going to be over now because it brings the resources to the case. The real party in the case is saying, I want to take this on. It was enormous. But the thing is what had happened at that time, too, is that there was a stay that had been placed on the case because there were three people who came forth from Northrop's legal team that was providing documents during the case. And they were saying and made affidavits that Northrop had been stamping everything attorney-client privileged that proved their guilt. And basically giving us paper snowstorms and haystacks with no needles. And some of the abuses that were going on in discovery abuses that put their attorneys at risk of facing prosecution. And the criminal side of the Department of Justice came back into the case. to take a second look at criminal charges, not just against Northrop for discovery abuses, but their attorneys. I can remember when we went in before Judge Guzman on the decision to allow the government to intervene during this time because there was a stay on the case, no action could be done. Northrop had their motion to dismiss before him again for summary judgment. And the government comes in and they're saying, well, we want to intervene in this case now. Our attorneys are there. Northrop's attorneys are there. The government, both criminal and civil, are there. Because the criminal was going to say they had no objection to the stay being lifted long enough to allow the civil side to follow their intention to intervene. Northrop making objections under the grounds of statute of limitations. The judge saying, this case is an active case. What are you talking statutes of limitations? It's an active case. It's still being litigated. The real partner in this case is the government, not just the whistleblower. So that's a moot point. But of course, there's a stay. He goes, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to lift the stay long enough for them to walk over here and hand me their intervention and then put the stay back on place before you can make an objection to it. And that's basically what he did. Wow. And they're saying, well, what about our summary judgment? And he goes, I will take that into consideration the day after this case is over. He wouldn't even entertain their summary judgment motion at that time or even during the prosecution of the case because it was just another delaying factor on their part. But he lifted the stay long enough for the government to intervene and then put the stay back in place. It was remarkable. I've never heard of anything like that ever taking place or having taken place again since. But it took place. And now the government was, it brought the resources. It brought the ability to bring an expert witness into our case. What a remarkable man. He became, I speak with him still to this day. General Charles Henry, Chuck Henry. Yeah. He was the general responsible for all the logistics of Desert Storm. He wrote the book for military appropriations. He sat on the commission to not just military appropriations for one branch of the service, but all five. I remember I was in the elevator with him after I was at one of his depositions, and he looks over at me, and it's just the two of us. And he goes, Jim, thank God for people like you.
Wow.
It just really touched me. He invites me down to Fort Lauderdale, and I haven't had the opportunity to get down there yet, but during his deposition, some of the things that came out. One of the strategies of their lead attorney for Northrop was to try to minimize people by claiming they were just clerks. They didn't know anything. You're just a clerk. Even their own 30B6 witness, expert witness on financial reconciliation was termed just a clerk. She didn't know anything when she was stripped of her informant status and her during one of the portions of the case that's spoken of in the book. But he tried to do that with General Henry. But how do you do that with somebody of this general's stature? So he gets rather manipulative in his speaking, and he says to the general, he goes, so you were responsible for all the logistics of Desert Storm. And the general goes, yes. He goes, so you were such things as bubble gum, cigarettes, uniforms. And you see where this is going? Yeah. It's nothing. Do you have any experience in the purchasing of weapons platforms? The look on the general's face was remarkable. I can still see it to this day. He sits back. He sits there for a second. He's just got this incredulous look on his face. Did you actually ask me that? And he says, well, do aircraft carriers, destroyers, tanks, and fighter jets count? And their attorney goes, well, let's go on to the next question. Mike looks over at me and he goes, that's why you never ask a question in a deposition you don't already know the answer to. So it's just, I can still see that. That was just great. I mean,
What a remarkable. One of my great memories with you, Jim, was having dinner with General Henry. Just a remarkable man. In 2005, the government and Northrop, along with you guys, reached a settlement for $134 million. When you found out that this long saga, at least this part of the case, was going to be over, what did you think?
Oh, my goodness. My wife and I, we both cried.
Yeah.
It was such a relief. We thought, oh, my goodness, this is, we can get on with our life. We can move forward. Right? And so now it was just, you know, I had to have taken a job where for the last 7 years, I was working 7 days a week, 365 days a year without a day off, delivering newspapers, being a Tribune agent. Several of those years, I was working with the Northwest or the Daily Herald and delivering, you know, making sure people got their newspapers just to try to feed my family.
Yeah.
Anything. And to be able to not have to do that, to be having to get up at midnight and work until 2 p.m. the next day. I had worked 5 years, 5 years of 365 days a year without a day off. It was incredible to be able, it ruined my health. The stress, the fatigue, that type of work, and other things too. Exposure to different things. It was just really something that I was hoping would now be all over.
One of the sad things of this case is Rex didn't make it to the end, right? Rex passed away in 2003, 2 years prior to this case settling.
Yeah, that broke my heart. I mean, he, towards the end of the case, the last year or so of the case, him and I talked every week. He moved out to the New Mexican desert to live in a trailer that someone had given him because he could never become gainfully. He tried. He just couldn't get gainfully employed again. Here's this remarkable individual who worked on every Apollo moon launch. And he was ruined, just absolutely ruined. He passed away, like you said, in 2003. I miss him still. I still remember him. I do a presentation called A Celebration of Heroes, where I talk about the story of that. And I talk about Rex. I show pictures of him. One of the things that we said that we would do is when this case ended was we would play Queens, We Are the Champions, on the court steps, not realizing that in Chicago there aren't court steps. This is a federal building, it's just a tower. You know, so, but you see him depicted in different TV shows, but that we were going to do that. You know, we are the champions and you are the losers, but I still play that at the end of every one of my presentations.
I see that.
And honor him of that.
Mike, this case inspired so many people to step forward and was one of the cases that I have pointed to for so many years. What's the lasting impact of this case, Mike?
I am just, it spawned future generations of people who are willing to follow Jim's lead. And lawyers who are willing to go the distance on difficult cases like Jim's, those where in particular the government doesn't intervene. And what it's shown is that dedicated relators, whistleblowers like Jim and their counsel can achieve great things against some of those powerful corporations in the world. Northrop is one of the hugest donors to both the Democrats and the Republicans. They mix with people at the highest level of government, and they provide some of the most sophisticated weaponry in the world. Yet a person like Jim and a person like Rex can take them on with the assistance of dedicated cadre of attorneys. And certainly, as you know, it wasn't just me who was putting this case together and pursuing it. My colleagues, Steve Miller, Bruce Howard, Tom Ash, Lisa Jacobson, Mike Jaskula, and Ron Futterman, who Jim mentioned, and many, many other attorneys and paralegals worked hard and risked their own capital. I mean, we went substantially into debt to finance this case because we believed in it. And that's what lawyers throughout the country are doing and have done for years and years in order to pursue taxpayer funds that have been defrauded from the government. And it's through cases like this and stories like Jim's that inspire many, many others to continue to do this into the future.
And Jim, there's likely somebody listening to this right now who is facing this moral dilemma about should they step forward or should they just go along to get along, be the sheep that we talked about earlier. What's your message to those people?
You have integrity. You absolutely have integrity. You can't buy integrity. You can give it away. You can sell it. But nobody can take it. So hold on to your integrity. Find competent legal assistance. This isn't something like you could talk about as your shade tree mechanic to work on your car. I compare it to that. You can't go get a shade tree attorney, one who is used to making phone calls on a workers' compensation claim. These are complex issues that have to be handled by someone who is properly trained. I have come to find over the years that the community of those attorneys associated with Taxpayers Against Fraud are not only competent, but ethical. They have integrity. So start your search there, because that's important. They'll be there to help you protect your rights, protect your ability to live your life, to rebuild. They had the insight and still have the insight of the mentoring project that was launched in 2007. Jeb, you were instrumental in that. Jim Moorman came up with the idea. You came on as the head of Taxpayers Against Fraud there and saw the importance of having a mentoring. And Mike, all the attorneys who have allowed that to take place. These are all things that, you know, there is help out there for people who have integrity. And don't sell your integrity.
Amen. Mike, Jim, I really appreciate you guys taking time to speak with us today. Such an inspiring story. I learned something today, and I thought I knew this case, but there's so many things to take away from this case. Perhaps most of all is that you guys have set the example for so many others to follow. And for that, I thank you. Thank you for your inspiration, your friendship, your fellowship, your mentorship over the years. And until next time, thank you for joining us on this episode of Fraud in America.
What a remarkable story. Mr. Holtz-Richter's whistleblower story was a 17-year odyssey against his former employer, Northrop Grumman. He brought the allegations under the False Claims Act to the attention of the government. The government was not interested in the case for whatever reason, but he decided to move the case forward anyways. And through a litigation battle, personal obstacles, and individual will, this case moved forward to a positive resolution, ultimately convincing the government to re-intervene in the case. But for Mr. Holtz-Richter and his co-relator, Rex Robinson, and their attorneys, this case, this recovery never would have happened. Today's story shows the power of the False Claims Act key TAM provisions, that a lone citizen can go up against a giant, a Goliath, a corporate Goliath, and win. But it takes a courageous whistleblower to step forward. Mr. Holtz-Richter and his co-relator, Rex Robinson, represent just that. And for that, the American taxpayer owes a debt of gratitude. Next week, we're going to go to Florida and spend time with another courageous whistleblower and her attorney as we go into the world of healthcare fraud. Join us next week here on Fraud in America.
If you believe you've witnessed fraud against the government at your job or want to learn more about these important laws to combat fraud, visit fraudinamerica.com. On our website, you can find whistleblower lawyers, blogs from these expert attorneys, and more. You can also find a transcript of today's show, show notes, a way to contact our team, and a way to chip in to make sure we can keep bringing you the latest on fraud. This episode was edited and produced by Rachel Brooks, and our theme music is by Connor Chaos. A big thanks to our staff and researchers of Jeb White, James King, Emma Bass, Jackie DeMar, Kate Scanlon, Brian Markovitz, and Max Boltman. You can learn more about them at fraudinamerica.com/team. Fraud in America is a project of Taxpayers Against Fraud Education Fund.